Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 69 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me questions, comments, and suggestions at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or you can join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Our guest today is Adam Lankford, who's published a lot on guns in the United States and around the world, and recently got some press attention by his research, which found a strong correlation between the number of guns in a particular country and the frequency of mass shootings. But before we get to him, the feedback of the week, this time from Bud Weiss, who is a health educator. Bud wrote, "A good friend of mine involved with HEAL, which is an organization that focused on treating immune deficiency without necessarily using antiretroviral drugs. A good friend of mine heard your interview with the anthropologist whose piece went viral through Huffington Post, etc. It was a great interview in which you were slowly destroying her credibility, but quite politely. I didn't get the chance to listen to the whole thing and wanted to do so and post it to all my Facebook pages and other places. Could you send me the link?" Well, I sent Bud the specific link, but just to reiterate, all episodes of The Infectious Myth can be downloaded from http://infectiousmyth.podbean.com. That's infectiousmyth.podbean.com. Bud continued, "I don't know if you saw what happened with the Kickstarter for the documentary I'm supporting, On the Back of a Tiger. They went way over the top, doubling their requested amount, and if this documentary gets done properly, you could really get a lot of folks interested in all the false stuff in medicine and other science. They did a great number of hours with Harold Hillman, and as an aside, I interviewed Harold Hillman in 2014, I think it was in April or May. They did a bit with Harold Hillman to edit for the documentary, and he was terrific. Thanks for all you are about, Bud." Well, thanks, Bud. Those are really nice comments. Let's go to the news of the week. There have been two recent articles in mainstream scientific journals talking about the overtreatment of ductal carcinoma in situ and the lack of effectiveness of treatment. This was talked about in the Infectious Myth episode 3 with Peter Gotche way back in March of 2014. Sagara in JAMA Surgery, August 1st, 2015, studied over 57,000 cases of this kind of cancer, which Gotche described as a often non-growing cancer, of which only 2% were managed without surgery, which says a lot about doctors' attitudes. For low-grade DCIS, survival was no higher in the treatment group. It was higher for moderate and high-grade DCIS. However, even this could be misleading because this was not a randomized controlled trial and therefore subject to bias. The population that didn't get surgery differed from those who did. For example, blacks were less likely to get surgery, possibly for financial reasons, and people who had other serious health conditions might have been less likely to get surgery. Observational trials like this tend to overstate the benefits of treatment. Narod in JAMA Oncology, published on August 20th of this year, studied over 100,000 women diagnosed with DCIS. They found that women who were treated had about the same risk of dying as those not treated, and that it was similar to the risk of dying in the general population of breast cancer, about 3.3% over 20 years. As Dr. Otis Brawley of the American Cancer Society said, "Doctors treat aggressively, then over the next 40, 50, 80 years, find out that we didn't need to be nearly as aggressive. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of American women suffer the consequences of unnecessary surgery and radiation." But now, let's go to our guest. Today's guest is Adam Lankford, a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, author of The Myth of Martyrdom: What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers, which offers unprecedented evidence that many suicide terrorists are suicidal in the conventional sense and are not mainly driven by ideology or commitment to the cause. This directly contradicts what most experts have insisted about suicide terrorists for decades. Professor Lankford has written for many publications, including the New York Times, Foreign Policy, Wired, The Daily Beast, New Scientist, The Mail on Sunday, and Scientific American, The Huffington Post, as well as peer-reviewed journals. His research has been featured by many U.S. and international radio and television networks. From 2003 to 2008, he helped coordinate senior executive anti-terrorism forums for high-ranking foreign military and security personnel in conjunction with the U.S. State Department's Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program. He has a PhD and MS in Justice Law and Society from American University, which is in Washington, D.C. So welcome to the show, Professor Lankford.
Thanks for having me.
So you got quite a bit of attention recently for what I think was a presentation at an academic conference, although the articles didn't actually include a link to it because I guess it wasn't publicly accessible. So can you describe what that was?
Sure. It was the, I believe, the 110th annual American Sociological Association meeting in Chicago, and that was my presentation was on August 23rd there to the members and attendees.
And I think the main message of the presentation was that when it comes to mass shootings, it's the number of guns that are available in society that's the biggest factor if you analyze it statistically. Is that a correct assessment?
Sure. So in terms of the stats that I gathered and then used kind of global stats, you know, from the United Nations, World Health Organization, things like that, the strongest statistically significant predictor of which countries have the most of these public mass shooters was firearm ownership rate. And I studied 171 countries over a 40-plus year span.
Yeah, I think one of the statistics you used was that the U.S. has 31% of the world's mass shootings, but only 5% of the world's population. So that's like a six times higher ratio than you would expect just based on the population.
Right. Wildly disproportionate is another way of saying it. Far
okay.
More than our share. Yeah.
Yes. That's an official statistical term, wildly disproportionate.
Right. Well, the disproportionate part is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Some people say that mass shootings are not that important because there's 30,000 firearm deaths per year in the U.S. approximately, and mass shootings represent a pretty tiny fraction of that. And you said in a paper you sent to me, public mass shootings by their nature are rare events, even in the United States. But why do you think they are important when the majority of people are being killed, ones or twos, in more mundane events?
Sure. Well, certainly there are a lot of different ways to determine what's important. I actually do a exercise in some of my classes with my students, challenging them with this same kind of thing. For instance, 9/11, you know, on September 11th attacks, we had, you know, approximately 3,000 Americans die, but 10 times that number die from traffic fatalities. So mm-hmm. There's a natural question saying, well, does September 11th even matter that much? And I guess what I would say is, yeah, a lot more matters than purely the number of fatalities from any incident. And in particular, what you see with these public mass shootings, much like with terrorism, is that it seems to have a kind of psychological effect on much of society. So purely in terms of the stats, you know, the stats say your chances of being shot, for instance, when you go to the movie theater are extremely tiny. You know, it's more dangerous to drive to the theater than to sit in the theater.
Right.
But the perception is that, you know, this summer people are scared to go to the theater, and that has its own sort of costs in terms of quality of life and how people feel about life.
Yeah, if I can use the Canadian analogy, I'm in Canada. You know, most people when they go to the mountains are overtly scared that they're going to be killed by a bear, even though the average number of deaths from bears in the whole of North America is about one per year over the last 100 years or so. And you're much more likely to be killed in a car accident or by a rock falling off a mountain or something like that. But it's somehow the drama of being killed by a bear and the fear of this that gets people's attention. But it's also important because there's a lot of numbness when it comes to gun crimes in the United States as well. And drama, I guess, draws people's attention that this is still a problem, maybe a growing problem.
Right, sure. And I think if you look at least modern human history, they're often catalyzing events which kind of stand apart, separate from kind of raw statistics in terms of what gets people to change their lives or change their priorities or change the laws.
Right, and there hasn't been a whole lot of changing laws recently. To get to the definition of a mass shooting, which is somewhat arbitrary, what definition did you use to distinguish a mass shooting from one of a lesser number of people?
Well, I was using a threshold, at least for the inclusion in this particular study, and I have looked at a broader set of offenders in previous research. For this study, I was looking at the attacker had to kill a minimum of four people, so four victims, in order to qualify, according to that phrase, mass shooter. And the threshold of four is something that's been cited by the FBI in the United States before. But as you said, you know, it is somewhat arbitrary. It doesn't mean that someone who kills three, for example, is necessarily, you know, psychologically different.
Yeah, I mean, last week there was the shooting on live TV of two journalists by a man who later killed himself, and that wouldn't qualify as a mass shooting, but it drew a lot of people's attention to the problem of violence just because people couldn't avoid, you know, a lot of people saw the video and actually saw the killing happen, which, you know, when a father kills his wife and children, usually there's no witnesses, and therefore it's not as dramatic and doesn't get as much attention.
Yeah, that's right. And in that particular case, it was in Roanoke, Virginia, the attacker was very similar to a lot of the other workplace shooters I've studied in terms of his psychology, you know, even the things he wrote in the suicide note and things like that.
Yeah, well, I'll get to ask you some questions about the psychology of these shooters later, because I think that's really important. But getting to the issue of gun ownership, you mentioned that the rate of gun ownership in the U.S. is 88.8 per 100 Americans, and second place was Yemen with 54.8, and Yemen's a war-torn country. What's the closest country that you would define as relatively stable that has a high rate of gun ownership, and what is that?
Yeah, I don't have the exact stat, but I know that looking at the top five in gun ownership, we did see in the top five United States, Yemen, Switzerland and Finland, and Serbia. So okay. Switzerland and Finland are relatively, you know, peaceful, mm-hmm, developed mm-hmm. countries.
And they still have rates of gun ownership, but would they be less than half the United States?
Significantly less than half.
Yes. And you found that this factor of gun ownership was related to the rate of mass shootings, whether the U.S., which is an outlier in many ways, was included or not.
So right.
Even among,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so even among countries like Finland and Switzerland or Germany and France, the rate of gun ownership was correlated highly with the rate of mass shootings in those countries.
Yeah, exactly. And that was for something that really surprised me. You know, I was kind of under this impression, you know, particularly, I guess, the history of war, that Switzerland, you know, is a peaceful place, you know, that they kind of mind their own business and don't have, you know, kind of the problems that the rest of us do in terms of violence. But it turns out, as you said, that basically in places where there are high numbers of firearms relative to the population, you have high numbers of public mass shootings. So it surprised me.
One of the differences between mass shootings in the U.S. And other countries is that a lot more mass shootings in other countries were in military settings. And is that just because guns are more available in military settings, or did you find any reasons for this?
Well, it's a good question, and that's something I'd like to look into more. I did have the same thought you did, which is, well, maybe it's, you know, even if you go to some of these countries where the civilian firearm ownership rate is relatively low, maybe you're basically having, well, the individuals in those countries in the military settings with easy access to firearms are the ones who are committing the crimes. And I guess a scary way of thinking about it would be, is it possible that, you know, the average civilian in the United States essentially have equivalent access to firearms as a soldier in another country. But I don't exactly know. That might be an empirically testable question. Another possibility that I wonder about is kind of looking at, again, the psychologies of these attackers and saying, you know, maybe it makes sense that there are these military shooters. In other words, of all mass shooters, maybe it's the easiest to understand why someone in the military, particularly when they're in a life and death situation and they've been forced, you know, in a lot of these countries, they still have the draft, mm-hmm. forcible conscription. So when you add, you know, forcible conscription, PTSD, military strains, maybe those shooters are kind of, in some sense, the most understandable compared to ours.
Yeah, you could definitely see that, like, especially if you're drafted into the military and lots of bad things could happen, and if maybe you've been unstable, that could, you know, you got access to a weapon, that would kind of be an accident waiting to happen, which is the most recent high-profile shootings. There's been a couple on military bases, but definitely the majority in the U.S. are not. Movie theaters, schools, things like that.
Right. If there's a tiny little glimmer of good news, I guess it's that the military shootings we've had in the U.S. are kind of on par with the rest of the world. They're not, you know, much more, you know, relative to the population like they are, you know, like the problem we have at workplaces, schools, and places like that.
Right. You also noted that 99.7% of mass shooters were male, and I'm sure when it comes to all shootings, there's a majority, significant majority are male, but this is higher than the rate of normal gun murders?
Yeah, significantly higher. In fact, I looked, there's something called the Uniform Crime Reports in the United States. It's basically a compilation of police reports from the entire nation that are managed by the FBI. And I looked at basically every type of homicide, and they're broken into, you know, different types. So, you know, gang killings, homicides that are the result of an argument, you know, so on and so forth. And none of them approach the ratio that we see with these public mass shootings. So overall, about 90% of homicides are committed by males in the United States. But of course, that's, you know, that's meaning 1 in 10 people who commit normal murder are female.
Right.
You know, compared to this, it was 1 out of 292 when it came to this type of offender.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting. Another thing that was a little bit counterintuitive, and maybe the only positive thing you found about mass shootings in America, is that in America, the mass shooters kill fewer people on average than in other countries.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me, because certainly when you think of some of the terrible attacks that have happened in human history, at least my mind gravitates towards things like Columbine, Virginia Tech,
right.
Sandy Hook. So I figured we'd have, on average, higher fatality levels too, and that turned out to not be the case. I guess the good news, well, at least my interpretation of what's going on there, and this is based on looking at some of the actual incidents, is that it seems like our law enforcement officers are better at responding.
I guess they have more practice.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which is not such a good thing.
They've had more practice, exactly. So one anecdote of kind of how we've changed in that respect is, if you look at the Columbine case, it took 3 hours for that incident to be resolved,
right.
From the time they started shooting to the time the incident was you know, the crime scene was cleared. And in those 3 hours, people were actually literally bleeding out and dying. So now at least we realize that, you know, when the first responders get there, they don't prioritize, like, securing the perimeter or waiting for backup.
They have to
stop the shooter right away. That's the priority.
Okay. So it is a matter of unfortunately having a lot of practice and experience that enables U.S. Police forces to respond more effectively. And I guess in other countries, the police aren't normally equipped with guns in every case.
Right. Yeah, there have been these unfortunate situations where the first officer to get there or local kind of law enforcement guy ends up getting shot as well. And then the incident goes on for hours.
Yeah, there's been a couple of cases in Canada where there's been shootings of police officers because the man with the gun had better guns than the even though Canadian police are armed, they were no match for the semi-automatic weapon that the shooter had, and not knowing what they were dealing with, they kind of walked into a death trap.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've looked at some of the suicide notes that are left behind by some of these mass shooters, and are there some general things that you can extract from that?
Sure. I guess we have a few things. One is, you know, the fact that they're often writing suicide notes kind of highlights the fact, and they often admit that they're suicidal. So we don't really know whether, you know, nearly 100% of these attackers are suicidal, or are they all suicidal or mentally ill? Another possibility is kind of saying they're all suicidal, or they don't care about their future. And you know, ultimately, look, we're talking about attackers who are planning in advance to kill, and they usually realize, based on previous attackers, that there's no chance they're going to you know, go on to live a happy and healthy and long life. You know, either they're going to prison, or they're going to die, either by their own hand or suicide by cops, something like that. So often you see some sort of despair and mental illness, and the person's own struggles with that. In addition, there's usually a sense of perceived victimization. So these attackers are they perceive that they themselves are the victim. So in other words, it's almost like framing violence as self-defense, right? I've been attacked, and now I'm just going back to right past wrongs, mistreatment, bullying, oppression, right, that has been done against me, right? And so they often perceive, you know, that my coworkers have been out to get me, or the principal, or my boss, things like that. Or sometimes it's just society in general is out to get me.
Yeah, I mean, I know there was a famous case in Canada where a guy walked into a group of engineering students specifically to kill women because he felt he was, I guess, a misogynist of some kind, felt that women were taking opportunities from him. And I know in a lot of countries, and especially in the United States, there's a lot of racism. People maybe blame black people for the reason of their lack of success. Did you see that kind of prejudice against a particular group in these notes?
Well, yeah, you see really every variation of anger and kind of blaming of others. So blaming of women, you know, blaming of liberals, blaming of people who are black. But this past week, we actually had the black attacker blaming, you know, kind of white supremacists.
Right.
You have also the blaming of Americans by people who have kind of Islamic jihadist ideologies. So, frankly, I don't put too much stock in, you know, who the particular offender has chosen to blame, because I think that's really kind of a manifestation of their warped psychology.
So would I be on track if I said that these people had decided to lash out and kill others, and their prejudices led them to a particular group? So if they hate. If they're blaming women for their problems, they're going to go look for a group of women to kill. If they're blaming anti-Islamic feelings, they're going to go kill people like soldiers or something like that. Is that?
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. So it's probably better to think about that as shaping their choice of target than being the underlying cause of their anger, because really, you know, if people are struggling with these problems and looking to blame someone, they're always going to be able to find, at least in their own head, some sort of target for their anger.
Yes, yes. I think the average person eventually starts to look in the mirror to say, if I haven't achieved what I wanted to achieve, maybe I should seriously consider doing something about myself, but there,
right.
are definitely that, some people who don't see it that way.
That would be more healthy, absolutely.
Yes. You noted that many of these mass shooters are socially isolated. Is that a pretty high percentage who are disconnected from society in general?
Yeah, so I guess there are different terms to be precise about it. We could say socially isolated, which is often true, and sometimes people use the term loner, which is often accurate as well. But I guess the other thing, a slightly broader way of looking at it, is socially marginalized. Okay. So people can in many cases are isolated, but in other cases, you know, they may have a few friends but still feel socially awkward or somehow that they're not socially satisfied. So for instance, the Columbine killers, well, they were friends with each other, but they still felt like they didn't fit in terms of the broader kind of social landscape.
Yeah, I understand. And you made an interesting comment in a paper that you sent to me that the argument is that even if we make guns more difficult to obtain legally, they're always going to be easy to obtain illegally. But you noted that these people don't have the social networks that would make it easy for them to find a guy who's likely to have, you know, likely to sell them guns on the down low.
Right, exactly. And that's one of those arguments you hear, you know, that if we make guns, you know, is somehow less easy to get legally, that they'll just automatically get them illegally. And look, that may be true for some types of individuals. It may be true for gang members or drug traffickers.
Right.
Or members of organized crime. You know, I don't think you're going to keep, you know, members of, you know, the mafia or something like that from getting guns altogether. But not these individuals. And making barriers, making it more difficult to get guns actually has a couple of benefits. One is, in the meantime, maybe something changes in their life and gets better. And two, if they still are set on getting those guns, there's also a chance that that, you know, law enforcement recognizes what's going on, or someone reports them, and an intervention can happen.
Right, right. So. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a bit like suicide, where when people attempt suicide, some people would just say, well, look, they wanted to kill themselves, like, don't stand in their way. But often it's sort of a short-term crisis, and if they're stopped in the suicide, a lot of people can recover and get back to a normal life. Also with guns, if somebody has a gun, the chances of the suicide being successful are much, much higher than cutting yourself or overdosing on drugs or even jumping from somewhere.
Exactly. And that's really what we know about human behavior in general, that when things are easy, it's more likely that people take that path. So, I mean, just a couple analogies. One would be, like, you know, everyone probably realizes with dieting, you know, if you have chocolate in your kitchen or chocolate, you know, at the grocery store, that's a big difference, right? You're much more likely to eat it if it's just sitting there in front of you.
Yeah, that's very true.
Right? So, I mean, someone could make the argument and they could say, oh, well, anyone could go to the grocery store and get chocolate, so it doesn't matter, you know, where it is. But
right.
But that's not how human behavior works. With suicide, as you pointed out, and a lot of these attackers are suicidal, they've shown that if you put up barriers on a bridge, which make it harder to jump off that bridge to commit suicide, not only do people not commit suicide there, but they're also less likely – it's not like they just go to another bridge and jump off that instead. In fact,
right.
They're just less likely to commit suicide altogether. So, you know, altering behavior kind of at that critical point can actually change someone's life forever.
Yes, yes. Did you see a high rate of drug use amongst these people in terms of illicit drugs or prescription drugs that could cause behavior changes?
I think in terms of illegal drugs, that's pretty rare. So that's certainly not something I could code for all of these attackers, particularly some of the ones in kind of remote areas of the world. I do know that, you know, some of them have used drugs. Some of them have used alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly like the one of the Columbine school shooters famously wrote in his diary about, you know, and this is a high school kid, how he was essentially self-medicating by drinking vodka alone in his room. But I think, you know, it doesn't seem like this kind of thing, alcohol or illegal drugs, is the cause of the problem. It's really, you know, an attempted mechanism of coping that has ultimately failed.
Right. I mean, you would expect to see maybe a higher than average use of substances amongst loners, because they're spending a lot more time alone and they're not in a lot of social circumstances where they might be doing other things. But you're saying it doesn't seem to be a big factor in this.
Right. You'd also expect, you know, if you're talking about a population that's 99.7% male and often young and often socially marginalized, well, it wouldn't be surprising if a significant number of them play video games. And, of course, right. They do. So,
right, which obviously proves that video games causes this.
I have a lot of students who get angry if anybody suggests that.
Yes. Some of the other countries that had double-digit mass shootings, the largest numbers of mass shootings between 1966 and 2012 were the Philippines, Russia, Yemen, and France. And are there any particular factors you can link to those? I was a bit surprised about France, because you wouldn't normally think of that.
Yeah, I was surprised as well. So I did this statistical modeling, and basically I said, well, what can I find that, you know, globally would explain the variation, why some countries have more than others? And the only thing that was statistically significant was the firearm ownership rate and the population, right? So naturally, bigger countries on average should have more of these attackers. But I guess some of the things that weren't significant were homicide rate, suicide rate, mm-hmm. GDP per capita in terms of the average wealth, and things like level of urbanization. You know, so some crime is associated with urban settings this crime was not. So I don't really have great answers for why those specific nations had so many. I do think in Russia in particular, we had a number of those military shootings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's probably cross-national differences in who goes into the military as well, right?
Right.
You know, my guess is we screen a little bit better. And of course, we don't have the draft here anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, I wonder why people have guns in France. Is it mostly for hunting? That definitely surprised me. Were most of the shooting in France in a military context?
Honestly, I don't remember the specifics there, because, you know, I'm looking at, you know, I try to look at 171 countries and it starts to blur. You know, obviously, if I was living in France, that would be something I'd want to look at very closely.
Yes. Okay, one question. I mean, doing this research, you're butting yourself up against, I mean, especially living in the southern U.S., against the Second Amendment of the Constitution, and if I can read it, it's pretty short. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Most people seem to interpret that to say that American citizens have a unlimited right to keep weapons, but I always wonder about the well-regulated militia part of that amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a major source of debate. I guess my perspective is, you know, I'm someone who studies criminal behavior more than the law, so.
Right.
I guess what I try to bring to this is, you know, frankly, an apolitical view, right? So there are political implications of studying and understanding criminal behavior, but, you know, I didn't come into this with any sort of specific political agenda one way or the other. You know, if it turned out that something other than firearms explained the variation in these attackers, you know, I would have reported it dutifully. So, one of the things that does strike me about kind of Americans' perceptions of firearms, though, that dovetails with what I've seen with these particular types of public mass shooters, is that so a lot of Americans, according to, you know, recent polling, say that you know, they need firearms because they need to be able to protect themselves from tyranny. And, you know, so obviously that's, you know, deeply seated in American history, you know, our Revolutionary War and things like that.
Right.
But I guess the scary thing is, you know, that sense that I need to protect myself from tyranny and essentially be able to rebel against it if I need to, that is the perspective that a lot of these school shooters and workplace shooters actually take on. So they feel like they've been oppressed, you know, tyrannized, you know, mistreated. So they actually feel like they're self-righteously, you know, essentially engaged in their own little personal revolution. So it's almost like the initial justification for having arms, just at another level of kind of distorted violence.
Yeah, well, I think that some of the people who kind of promote the free right to arms, whether they're politicians or media personalities, and especially some of the stuff I've read online is treading pretty closely to the right to go out and kill people you don't like, which is what these mass shooters do.
And right, especially if there's some way you can frame it as self-defense or as if those people are violating some sort of rights of your own.
Right. I mean, the perception that the government of the United States doesn't represent the people, which I guess a lot of people who don't have guns also feel that's the case with most governments, especially with the flood of corporate money into governments. There's a big question about whether it represents the people, but not everybody thinks that the solution is to go get a gun. And it's also interesting that, you know, in the United States recently, and let me know if I'm getting too political, but, you know, there's been a huge number of laws and sort of secret agreements that allow eavesdropping on people and things like that, which you would think that these people would be politically opposed to, and yet this has all happened without as much pushback as some people would want in terms of people phoning their congressman or senator or to oppose these infringements on privacy.
Right. Yeah, the privacy stuff is interesting. I guess people want want their own guns, and yet want the in some cases want the privacy of others to be violated if they're doing something wrong. Right.
Right.
A lot of it seems to boil down to self-preservation. Privacy is interesting because it seems to just be disappearing for everyone, though.
Yes.
You know, kind of in our modern age.
Yes. Well, what with corporations, you know, every time you log on to onto a website, plus what the NSA and others are doing behind the scenes, there's not much that you can do these days that you can guarantee is secret unless you go into a very isolated part of the forest.
Right, exactly. I was going to say even the cameras on public streets, right?
Yes.
Or satellites from above.
Yes, and you'd have to do it without any electronic devices on your person at the same time. So, yes, achieving privacy these days is difficult.
Right. I guess one of the good things about that, though, was how quickly they were able to track down this Roanoke shooter. And I guess they kind of geolocated him using his cell phone.
Right. Yes. But, again, I guess they could have done that it would be pretty easy to get a warrant in a situation like that. I think any judge would roll over in half a second to say certainly. And I think there's also provisions where you can do certain things if you can claim that there's an emergency, like an active shooter, for example, so you don't need to get a warrant in those cases.
Sure. Certainly the technology is subject to abuse.
Yes, but also subject to valid use, which is a good point. Do you think that, I mean, since the last couple of decades, there's been basically the destruction of manufacturing in the United States, and what, you know, many working class people in America used to be able to get a good job working at the auto plant or something like that, and those have gone. So there's a lot more underemployed or unemployed blue collar people. And do you think that the sort of increasing struggle of the underclass in America has increased the number of these shootings, or is that not really a big factor?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think we would say, for instance, unemployment alone. I actually did look at unemployment as another factor across nationally, and it didn't seem to be correlated with these types of things. And certainly when you look globally, we'd say that there are a lot of countries where people are doing worse, right? Struggling more, at least from a survival standpoint, than Americans. So what I've been looking at is kind of an application of something called strain theory, actually, that dates back to Robert Merton, a famous sociologist in 1938, who looks at really the gap between people's aspirations and sense of what they should achieve and their ability to achieve those goals. So the idea being it's not where you are now in terms of quality of life or social kind of status that matters. It's the gap between where you are now and what you feel like you're entitled to or where you should be. And, of course, in America, a lot of people seem like they have very lofty senses of where they should be.
Right. Well, I mean, in America, you're continually bombarded by pictures of people who've got infinite money. You know, they've got everything, right? Nice car, beautiful family, vacations in exotic places, and you're sitting in your parents' basement.
Right, and the added part of that, though, is, you know, there's, I guess, kind of a false myth that America is just purely kind of a meritocracy.
Right.
But the real anger, I think, and resentment starts when you look at someone who has all this stuff and you say, I'm smarter than him or her, right? This person's a reality TV star or had a sex tape or, you know, hit the lottery. Why does this person have all this stuff when I'm, in fact, I deserve it and that person doesn't? That's where things get nasty.
I mean, would you say, judging by what you've read, that these people are generally highly intelligent or is there a wide variety there?
I think there is a variety, but particularly among the school shooters, I've been surprised at kind of how, I guess, thoughtful and intelligent a lot of them are. So, you know, your average student isn't struggling with topics of existentialism, right? Philosophy.
Right.
But a lot of these individuals are. And we've also had, you know, for instance, the Aurora Theater shooter. You know, he was a PhD student. So
like in molecular biology or something.
I guess I've been struck by, you know, the fact that a lot of these attackers seem to be middle class or doing okay, and seem to be above average in their intelligence. And, you know, that's where things can get tricky because they feel like, oh, well, I'm better than everyone around me, you know. That can feed these delusions of grandeur, the confidence, actually.
Right. Do you have any opinions on what America could do in terms of rules, regulations, laws to reduce school shootings? Not school shootings, to reduce mass shootings? I mean, obviously, you're targeting the number of guns that are available. Are there proposals that you think would be able to do that and therefore reduce the number of mass shootings?
You know, it's an interesting question. One thing that's been talked about certainly is increasing kind of the rigor and comprehensive nature of background checks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that's perfect by any means, because some of these attackers don't have criminal histories, for example. But that is another barrier that makes it a little more difficult. And in some cases, you know, I think some of these individuals clearly had, you know, severe mental health problems and probably would have been prevented from getting weapons. So background checks could help. You know, I actually heard someone else suggest that people who drive cars have to have liability insurance. People who own guns should have to have it too.
Right.
With the idea that if you have an insurance company essentially giving out policies for people who have guns, the insurance company will have an incentive to make sure that it's charging according to the risk of the individual. You know, So if you're a 22-year-old, you know, with a DUI, it's going to be very hard to get driver's insurance. And you know, if you're in some demographic or some behavioral profile that suggests you're at higher risk of committing any sort of gun violence, maybe it would be less likely that you could be insured for a gun.
Right. I mean, would you say that anything that reduces the number of guns is likely to reduce the number of mass shootings just by reducing the accessibility? Is that a message that we'd get?
Well, that's what the global data suggests. So, you know, so for instance, some people say, well, you know, the NRA has argued that more guns will make us safer. And I'd say, well, that's a hypothetical, but that doesn't seem to be true anywhere in the world based on the 171 countries I studied. So, yeah, reducing guns would seem to have an impact. And the other thing is, I guess on an individual level, one of my findings was that attackers in the United States were more likely to use multiple weapons. But overall, globally, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, there was a correlation between multiple guns use and fatalities. So people who used multiple weapons instead of a single weapon killed on average more victims.
And I presume that would also go to say that the high-capacity magazines, which have also been kind of controversial, would also, like if you couldn't get those, that would also presumably reduce the number of people you'd be likely to kill.
I would think so. That isn't something I've been able to code yet, but I certainly would think so. So there's an interesting kind of point to be made. In fact, I think Joe Biden, you know, the vice president, came out at one point and said, if you want a gun for personal protection, just have a shotgun. That's enough for personal protection. So there's an idea that even if we just could make sure that a mass shooter could get one gun instead of two, or just one handgun instead of a gun with high-capacity magazine, that, you know, even if it wouldn't prevent one shooting, it would limit the number of fatalities significantly.
Yes. The United Kingdom and Australia cracked down on gun ownership in some ways. I think it was in 1996 where they both had big mass shootings, Dunblane in the UK and the Tasmania shooting in Australia. Do you know how much gun ownership fell following the change in laws? Did you look at that?
Yeah. So in Australia, they had a reduction in total civilian firearms by about 20%. So that's a significant amount, but you know, it wasn't like they went from, you know, 100 to zero. So a 20% reduction in Australia in firearms, and they actually haven't had a public mass shooting since.
Right. And presumably a lot of the guns that were eliminated were the guns that became illegal, like semi-automatic weapons, things like that. So it wasn't just like a random reduction in guns. Is that correct?
Right. I think there were specific restrictions on the types of guns that were legal following the restrictions. And the restrictions, if I recall correctly, you know, they acted quickly. So it was like they had a shooting where 35 people were killed. It was one of the worst actually in modern history. Mm-hmm. And within a few weeks, they started passing some of these gun control restrictions.
And it was actually a right-wing government that did it, which is kind of ironic. And a similar experience in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, so I haven't looked at that as closely, but I know that, you know, certainly there's no comparison between the current level of firearms, you know, in the United Kingdom, or I even looked at comparing the United States versus the members of the European Union, and really just no comparison either in the firearms or in the number of public mass shooters over this, you know, 40-plus-year period.
Right. One of the things I'm confused about is like sometimes you think that organizations like the NRA want no restrictions on guns, and yet there are pretty hard restrictions. Like you're not allowed in the United States to have an automatic weapon if you're a civilian. I mean, maybe it's possible, but it would probably be very, very difficult to get permission to do that. And yet semi-automatic weapons, there's no problem at all with. Is there a – I mean, have you heard a good – a legitimate argument for somebody, a civilian, owning a semi-automatic weapon? I never got my head around that.
Not really. I mean, I guess there are various explanations given on why people need different types of weapons, and I guess the thing I've heard that you can tell me whether you think this is compelling or not, which is that it really comes back to that need to be able to protect ourselves from tyranny. So the argument I heard was, what if we had a Hitler-type figure rise up to power in the United States? We can't take him down just with a handgun. We need our guns to be able to, you know, take someone like that out of power. And the argument is, well, you might think that's absurd, but it has happened this century in another country. So that's the argument I heard.
Yes. I'm just thinking about the arms that the U.S. military, police, and other armed sections of the government, like the Border Patrol and DEA, mm-hmm. like the weapons they have. I mean, you get into a situation like the Waco disaster, right, where although the organization had a lot of guns, they were just drastically out-armed. Not just guns, right. But the U.S. had all kinds of things, the U.S. government, that the people in Waco didn't have.
Right, I agree. So if you take that argument that we need enough guns to be able to topple the government, you know, as civilians, that's a, you know, that's a slippery slope that leads to, well, why shouldn't we have tanks?
Exactly.
And, you know, everything else, right? Shoulder fired missiles and things like that.
Well, I read an article recently that I think Michigan is talking about outlawing flamethrowers. And I had no idea they were legal, but apparently they are. Some of them can fire flames like 25 meters or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there could be an arms race to grenade launchers and things like that to have any chance of fending off a tyrannical government. But maybe I would say until people are actually fully engaged with their political system, that is that everybody goes to help nominate a candidate and everybody writes letters and things like that, maybe we could try the nonviolent approach first before we decide that the only way to change the government's mind is to start killing people.
Right, and the other thing is, how many people are you going to let die in the meantime while you're waiting for some hypothetical tyrant down the road?
Well, that's probably the biggest argument against personal gun ownership is how many people are killed by their own children, or how many people accidentally kill their own children, or, you know, in a fit of anger, pick up a gun and shoot it before they really think about what they're doing. That seems a much bigger danger than anything you're going to be able to protect against.
Sure. I think people often kind of assume that, well, with law enforcement in this country, sometimes you see it like on the side of the police car to protect and serve. And I think sometimes the assumption is that the criminal justice system is here just to protect us, you know, good people from the bad people. But in reality, sometimes we need to be, you know, protected from ourselves, or our children need to be protected from themselves. You know, that's why you have things like seatbelts, helmets on motorcycles, right, and a variety of other things. So, making it less likely that your kid in a moment of just getting dumped before prom does something stupid, either in an attack or to himself in despair, that has a benefit, right?
Right. We've come towards the end of the time for this interview. Is there anything important on the subject that I've missed that you'd like to bring up?
Well, I guess I would just add, we've talked about, you know, both guns and culture. One of the things that really strikes me is this issue of fame seeking.
Oh, okay.
And in particular, I guess I was just so struck by a Pew Research Center survey, which found that 51% of Americans, young Americans, said one of their generation's most important goals is to be famous. And I guess I would just say, maybe that's something kind of parents and You know, friends, mentors, maybe that's something we can reverse at a low cost. In other words, teaching your kid that it's better to be kind of an anonymous good person than a famous person of questionable morals, right? That really comes at no cost, and I think will ultimately make people kind of more happier with how their lives turn out.
Yes, yeah, I guess that is philosophically important. If you can be important to your family and to your friends and to your colleagues at work, you know, maybe that's the definition of a good life. You see so many people in politics and in Hollywood, and they don't really seem to be happy. And in the end, it often doesn't end well for those people. So, yeah, maybe if we lower our sights to what's realistic and what's more human, it would be better.
Right. Or, I mean, it's fine to strive for all sorts of great things, but just realize that ultimately, you know, things like, I think you're 100% right. Those people who get fame, they just start looking for something else to fill that void. So that's not any sort of miracle path to happiness.
Yes, and particularly when you get fame with a gun, it's really sad. Anyway, thank you for joining me today. This discussion has been fascinating, and I definitely like to hear from my listeners on this, especially gun owners, to hear what they think about this. Not just them, but everybody on this important issue.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you, and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 69 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow the discussion there, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, thanks for listening, and goodbye.